Morning is case number six, Harger Mechanical versus Patrick Tierney. You may proceed.
Thank you. Just parenthetically, I had expected an Assistant Attorney General to appear.
Did they even file a brief in this case?
I don't think they did, but they certainly were a party.
Well, they're not here, so we're going to proceed. Do you wish to reserve any time for...
Yes, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, if you would, please.
Yes.
So, my name is Ann Silvernail. I represent, in this case, the employer, Harger Mechanical, and this is a Department of Labor and Industries case brought under Title 51. We're asking this court to consider the issue of when a worker's relationship to work is intermittent, such that his wages should be calculated under subsection 2 of 5108-178. I'm not going to belabor the point too much of a statutory scheme for determining what a worker's wages are. That it's oddly more complicated than one would imagine, but there are two sections of the statute. One simply takes the wages as though somebody worked a full-time job all the time with, you know, probably had some vacation and so forth. There is, however, a lot of jobs that don't work that way, and there's a lot of people who don't work that way. And in that case, we're dealing with subsection 2, which permits averaging when somebody has a intermittent or part-time relationship to work. Now, the court yesterday did email both parties asking specifically to address a piece of Gorry, that's G-O-R-R-E, versus City of Tacoma, and you asked the Superior Court can make its own findings or reach a different result only if the judge finds by a preponderance of the evidence that the board's findings and decisions are erroneous. And we were asked, in light of this, should the Court of Appeals review the board's findings for substantial evidence rather than the Superior Court's findings? We did some additional research, and what I had assumed was the case is the case. And in fact, the Court of Appeals reviews the Superior Court's findings of fact to see if they're supported by substantial evidence. That also is indicated in the Supreme Court went on in Gorry to explain that substantial evidence review occurs on the findings made after the Superior Court's de novo review. And on appeal from the Superior Court, the appellate court must ascertain whether there was substantial evidence to support the findings of the trial court. And I did not have time to prepare a supplemental brief, but if the court desires, we can do that.
Well, you have
the question would be part of your argument in your brief. I mean, I realize this is not the main thrust of your argument because you're really attacking both the board and the Superior Court. But one of your arguments is that the Superior Court did not make adequate findings. And but the board's findings were more complete. And so to the extent that you're asking us to hold that the decision has to go back because the finding itself is insufficiently specific, where that would not be true of the board's findings, that would kind of eliminate that argument.
Well, I would think it is true of the board's findings itself. I mean, certainly those were we filed a petition for review. The way it works at the board level is that a proposed decision and order is issued, and you can petition for review. The board can either grant review or deny review. In this case, it denied review without saying anything more, so we have just simply the proposed decision and order.
Right, but you have one of the things that you criticized the Superior Court for is that it did not have anything except that he had alternating periods of employment and unemployment. Whereas the board's findings do specifically specify, they specify exactly the periods of time when he did work. So to the extent that you are saying that we have to throw the whole thing out because the Superior Court's findings did not include those dates, that would be wrong, would it not? Because the statute and what the way that it was interpreted in Gorey would be that, this is what I would propose, is that the where the board's findings are complete and specific and you know, adequate to support appellate review, all and the Superior Court agrees with the board and says, as this judge did, Judge Chechkov said, I think that the board is right, I don't have any problem with the board, you know, then we're going to look at, the Superior Court really isn't under any obligation to say anything more than after de novo review, I find that the board is correct.
And it didn't do that. It made findings.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it was you who was there, but the Harder said you have to make findings, Your Honor. And so to accommodate that request, and okay. The other side didn't really disagree, that then there was a hearing on findings, and the court entered the findings. But the point of the court's question here today is that really is not, there's no obligation under the statute for the Superior Court to make those kind of detailed findings when the board has already made them and the court is just agreeing.
You know, Your Honor, I would take the position that the board didn't make adequate findings, and the fact that, but
if that's what you want to say, but that's not exactly what you argued in your brief.
Okay.
You argued in your brief that the Superior Court findings were insufficiently specific, and I guess the point of our question is, what doesn't it make more sense before we go off in that direction to look at the board and see if the board's findings are sufficiently specific under the Avundis test?
And I'm not sure that the rules for appellate review permit that necessarily. But again, you know, I understand
that's
the court's
probably
concern.
Probably not the rest of your argument.
No.
So why don't you go ahead?
No, it truly is not. But again, I appreciate the question. I appreciate the opportunity to clarify to the extent that's been done. And the court's referred to Avundis, and I think that's the place to start, frankly. Avundis sets forth a two-part test for determination as to whether or not someone's wages should be calculated as if they were intermittent, in other words, averaged, right? Otherwise, that person's wages, what's imputed to that person, imputed to that worker, is 52 weeks a year of continuous work. Now, in Avundis, the court set forth a two-part test, and the first part was, is it the type of employment that's intermittent? And it's not disputed that pipe fitting is not intermittent. Pipe fitting's around all the time. It's not seasonal, although that does beg the question whether or not it's seasonal work or...
Let me ask you this, based on what you're just saying. Are you mounting here a broad attack decisions made under Avundis that allow somebody to be considered a part-time worker whenever they actually don't work, you know, when their history is maybe only 30 to 35 weeks?
No.
So
no.
I'm concentrating on this particular case,
and I'm running out of time. What I want to make very clear is this. There is evidence in the record that shows that Mr. Tierney never intended to work on a full-time basis.
No.
Which two? I'm sorry.
The first one, the one that you agree is there, what the nature of the employment was not part-time or intermittent, and the
right.
board's finding that he intended to work full-time, which I understand you think is not supported, but suppose it is. Then how could a reviewing court say, well, two out of two isn't enough?
You know, I think the court has to look at all of the factors and weigh them. I don't think any one or two is dispositive, but I do think the court has to look at them all.
Well, the board has weighed it. The Superior Court has weighed it. How can we do otherwise then unless, you know, I mean,
our position is
some kind of a test, right?
Yeah.
You have to have three out of four, or what are you suggesting as the way that the appellate court would review that?
Well, to begin with, it's our position that his intent was never to work on a full-time basis. And that is not supported by substantial evidence.
You're
and I am
eating into your rebuttal time here.
Yes.
You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is John Wallace. I represent Patrick Tierney, the respondent in this matter. I understand that the court wants us to address the issue of whether or not the Superior Court should have made its own findings of fact and conclusions of law, or should have simply adopted the board's findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Well, I don't know if it should, but that's an option, isn't it?
I do believe it's an option, yes. And in reading the Gore versus City of Tacoma case, it sounds like that's probably what you should do if the Superior Court agrees that the board didn't err, which is what I believe the Superior Court did.
Well, doesn't that make sense? Then as has been suggested, the order would say, I've reviewed the record de novo and agree with the board's findings. Then you don't get into this dispute about whether there are differences between the Superior Court findings and the board findings.
Yeah, I agree. That makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah, so on behalf of Mr. Tierney, I mean, we're fine if the court reviews the Superior Court's findings of fact or the board's. In reviewing them, I think they're pretty minor differences. So if the Superior Court committed any error in issuing its own findings of fact, I would say that error would be harmless.
Well, how getting to the merits then, what's your proposal as to how a reviewing court would go about it? I mean,
regarding the findings of fact?
Yeah, I mean, it's de novo review. We have these four factors, and Harder is suggesting that, okay, they're agreeing, okay, the nature of his employment was not part-time or intermittent. That's established. Pipe fitters necessarily don't work for the same person all year round. But they say, well, you know, there's really not enough evidence that he intended to, and that, you know, the facts are really make this case kind of an outlier that should move it over to that other side. I mean, he had, for the last 3 years, I guess, before the injury, just not didn't have very many days of work. And his relationship to Harder certainly wasn't extensive. He'd worked for them for 4 days and got injured, and there's nothing in the record that indicates he expected to work for them for a long time. So here you've got, from the standpoint of Harder, you've got somebody who's going to get paid $95,000 a year when he never did get anything like that in previous years. That's the dilemma that they're looking at. And by the way, how long is he going to get paid those kind of payments?
Real quick, it's an aside, but he doesn't get paid that. That's the basis of what time loss is compensated at. And so he gets being single with no kids, he gets 60% of that. Okay. And until he's found employable, which he's long been found employable. So it was just while he's not employable due to his industrial injury.
Thank you for clarifying.
But to get to the merits of your question, which is kind of, the heart of my argument here, is so, yeah, we have these four factors under the second prong of the Evanes test. One is the nature of the work, undisputed that it's not intermittent. Number two is the worker's intent, which we see that there's Mr. Tierney testified that his intent was to work full-time. He testified, and the evidence shows that he was always either working or had his name on the union dispatch list looking for work. That's how union members look for work. You put your name on the dispatch list. On that dispatch list, he held himself out to work in two different trades, pipe fitting and plumbing. He put himself out to work in all seven geographic zones of Local 26. That ranges from the Canadian border down to the Oregon border, Western Washington, excluding King County. So those evidence support the Superior Court's finding that he had the intent to work full-time. The relationship with the current employer, yeah, that was temporary, as is the nature of working out of a union hall. But, yeah, that factor would favor, you know, probably intermittent work. The Mr. Tierney's work history, yeah, it was inconsistent, and there were periods of time of unemployment. So that factor arguably would favor Harder Mechanical as an intermittent worker. So you got two factors that favor full-time worker, two factors that favor intermittent worker.
So what tips the scale?
So the case in Watson versus Department of Labor and Industries is probably the most helpful case on this. Exact same thing there. That case was a guy who was a groundskeeper at a golf course, and he worked from spring until fall every year and was unemployed the rest of the year. He got hurt, filed a workers' comp claim. Same issue came up. Is he a seasonal intermittent worker or is he a full-time worker? The evidence in that case was his testimony that said he always wanted to work full-time and that when he was not working, he was collected unemployment. There's no testimony that he was actually looking for work when he was unemployed, but the court assumed that because he was receiving unemployment, he must have been looking for work. So the And they said he was a general laborer, and so general labor work is available year-round. So the nature of the work and his intent favored full-time work in Watson. The work history, 3 years of working just in the springs and, you know, from spring to fall, favored seasonal intermittent worker. And, oh, the relationship with the employer. It was undisputed. The employer testified that we hired him as a seasonal worker. That's all we ever intended. And so those, almost the same here. Two factors for and two factors against. And the court said, so we got to weigh this. We got to figure out how to weigh this. And there's a paragraph on that in Watson. And it says, the guiding principles looking back to Abundes. And in and they quote Abundes saying, the focus here is to look at the injured worker's lost earning capacity. And the court in Watson went on to say, Mr. Watson had the capacity to work full-time. He just was unsuccessful in finding full-time work. But he intended to work full-time, and when he wasn't working, he was looking for work. Therefore, the court concluded he was a full-time worker. So in this case, we have a union pipe fitter, plumber, who's been doing this for 34 years, who was always either working.
How many years?
34?
Oh, is that how long he's been a pipe fitter?
I believe so. Yep, 34 years. This is, you know, this is his whole career. And he testified he was always either working or had his name on the list.
Well, you just said both. So he's a pipe fitter slash plumber?
Yeah, he's licensed for both trades. Most of his work's in pipe fitting. But he checked the boxes that he'd do pipe fitting or plumbing work when he signed the dispatch list. In Watson, it was pretty clear that the factors that are given the most weight would be the worker's intent and the nature of the work. But clearly, when there's two factors against two factors, the weight is given the most would be in favor of the intent.
I'm not sure if I have this right, but Watson, I think, is the case where there's this, yeah, and I think you mentioned it, it's about unemployment. But Harger here says that same inference can't be drawn because of the specific nature of how unemployment is.
Correct. We don't need the inference here.
And you're not asking the court to draw it then?
No, we don't. His name was on the dispatch list. By having Mr. Tierney's name on that dispatch list, he's in fact looking for work. That's how they do it in his trade. You go do a temporary job construction project. When the job ends, you go back to your union. You put your name on the dispatch list. You wait till your name gets to the very top again. You get offered a job. You take it, and you go out on the next job. How long it takes for that list to rotate till you get the next call varies depending on the amount of work available in the trade. And so by having his name on that dispatch list, he was, in fact, looking for work. So we don't need the inference that was needed in Watson.
But apparently he gets unemployment if he has his name on the dispatch list.
He does.
So the inference that Harder says is compelling and that should be found by a court weighing the evidence is that really Mr. Turney was quite comfortable drawing unemployment and just wasn't trying very hard to get hired because of the fact, as shown by the very infrequent nature of the jobs where he actually did work and the fact that there were a number of times when he kind of was self-inflicted.
I'd like to address those real quick. So he was looking for work. There's nothing that you can draw from the evidence that he was comfortable collecting unemployment. His name was on that dispatch list. I don't think there's evidence in there that says he turned down work. Like he's offered a job and says, no, I don't want it. That's
well,
not
turned a couple of them back in, I think.
Back in, after he accepted it. So there were six occasions in 5 years where he couldn't do the work. Sorry, I'm talking fast. I'm almost out of time. So there's six occasions where he couldn't, where he accepted the job, fully intending to do the job, but for whatever reason couldn't go through with it. One of those occasions, he showed up to the job site to work and was turned away, rejected by the contractor. The other one, he shows up to work at the job site, fully intending to work, but at Fort Lewis, but he turned away because he didn't have car insurance. They won't let him on the base. Another one, he accepted a job, fully intending to do it, but he injured his knee and so had to turn that job back in. So there's three other that we don't really know. He couldn't remember why he couldn't take the job. But he accepted the job, fully intending to do it, but most likely got sick, heart troubles, whatever, variety of reasons, legitimate reasons why after you accept the job, you're like, oh, I can't do this, and you give it back in. Six occasions in 5 years, and none of those show an intent not to work full-time. He took the jobs, and two of them, he showed up and just got turned away. So we believe there's substantial evidence to support that he had the intent to work full-time, and that it's undisputed that the nature of the work is full-time. And so when you're balancing these factors, as the court did in Watson, we believe that the trial court, the Superior Court, should be affirmed.
Thank you.
I'm going to talk fast.
You still have 2 minutes.
Your Honor, in Watson, what the inference was held because the person was on unemployment, and that means you have to go look for work. In the union world, if you are on a dispatch list, that's it. That's all you have to do. In this case, the evidence is that Mr. Tierney turned down work, didn't get on base because he didn't have car insurance. It's illegal to be on the road without car insurance in the first place. He didn't keep himself at a point where he could go. This is completely volitional on his part. So, and the other reality is, actually, if you look at the record, is that if somebody turns down a job, it doesn't matter for unemployment. You can stay on the list, turn down a job, and you still get unemployment. He's not entitled to the inference in this particular situation. We also haven't even addressed the fact that he was in jail for 4 months based upon the commission of a second assault in the second degree. He got numerous calls at that time, but he couldn't respond to any of them, obviously. He didn't even see fit to inform the union that he was going to be off the list for that period of time. That's something he controlled. So to say that he intended to work full-time, intended to be ready, willing, and able to be on that list and do all these jobs is simply not supported in the record. Now, the last I would leave you with is this. We have the record shows all we had was his work records from October of 2008 to March or April of 2012. And that's 42 months. Of that, he was off work for 31 months. For whatever reason. And some of that time certainly includes not showing up, not answering the phone when they called him, being in jail because of a volitional act. This person is not entitled to that inference. It would be a windfall, and I'm going to ask the court to find that he's an intermittent worker within the meaning of the statute.
Thank you.